My name is Jerry, and I'm glad to know I'm not the only one that has short-term memory loss, you know. What step am I on? Eight? Is it eight? Yeah. I tell you what, if it wasn't for flashbacks, I wouldn't have any memory at all, you know. It's just terrible. What I like to do usually is kind of go over just a little bit, and I do this more briefly in some meetings than others. But I asked Teresa to have somebody read the promises tonight, because the promises come after step nine. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about step eight and nine tonight. I usually do those kind of together. I don't know if I'll finish tonight. Those have a lot to do with relationships. And really, when you stop to think about it, just about all the steps have something to do with relationships. The first one has to do with our relationship with ourselves. It's the time we start to get honest about ourselves, what's going on. Steps two and three have to do with our relationship with God as we understand them. Step four, we begin to get honest with ourselves about our relationships to others and to God. And step five, we admitted it to God, to ourselves, and other people. And that, again, deals with relationships. Steps six and seven are obviously with relationships to God. And in steps eight and nine, we are cleaning up the wreckage of the past in terms of how we have affected other people, the harm we have done, and we're trying to undo, amend, which means to heal, to repair, to restore to its previous good state our relationships with other people as much as possible. You know, and I don't know what it takes. I have just been overwhelmed this week with a sense of gratitude. I've had a chance to be with some really neat people that I know in the program, some people that I've come in with and some that have come in after me and I've had an opportunity to work with, and it just amazes me. You know, one of the things that amazes me is I'm sitting up here and I'm doing the steps. I had such a hard time with these things. I mean, kicking and dragging and screaming all the way through the things. And I asked my sponsor one time, I said, why am I having such a hard, why is it, you know, I can't seem to get this thing. Why am I having such a hard time with this? Or why have I had such a hard time with it? And he said, Jerry, I don't know. He said, maybe so someday you'll understand when somebody else has a rough time with it. And that was after 2 years of going in and out and slipping. And, you know, they said, keep it fresh. You know, for 2 years, I thought you meant kept going back and picking up white chips. I don't know. Can you ever hear the story of the alcoholic rabbits? Never hear the story of the alcohol. The names were Foot, 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 and Foot, Foot, Foot. And they lived in New Orleans. And these alcoholic rabbits, they always kind of ran together and drank together and, you know, run with their buddies and all that. And one day, after going out on a drinking spree, Foot ran out in front of a truck and got killed. So Foot, Foot, and Foot, Foot, Foot had an alcoholic rabbit funeral for him, which is kind of like a, you know, Irish wake. And they went to the funeral and they got a little blitz while we're there at the funeral. And then after the funeral, they're sitting up on this wooden fence post, you know, sitting up there like alcoholic rabbits sit, you know, with their ears kind of lopsided and, you know, a little red nose and all that kind of stuff. And Footfoot said to Footfootfoot, he says, oh, I don't know, what are we going to do now, you know, now that Foot's gone? And Footfootfoot said to Footfoot, he says, I don't know. He says, I guess the only thing left to do is join AA. And Footfoot said to Footfootfoot, what do you mean join AA? He says, well, we may as well. We got one foot in the grave already. You know, and that's kind of the way we do things, too. You know, if we wait until we get one foot in the grave, I'm sorry, I'm going to do that again. Okay. Really stretching tonight, Jerry. Y'all got to be serious. You know, this is one of the things about step eight. On. How's that? Is that better? Okay. I feel like I was shouting. One of the things about step eight, when we get into it, it talks about making a list of people we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And one of the things I want to emphasize about these two steps, you know, we're not doing, so I think sometimes we have the impression that we're doing steps eight and steps nine for the other person, and that the results of these steps is how they accept us and whether they forgive us and whether we get back into good standing with them or not. We are not doing these steps for other people. These are our steps. It's part of our program of recovery, and it's something that we have to do if we're going to walk around loose and free and reasonably happy in this skin, in this world. And step eight means we make a list of the people we've harmed. It talks about making the list. He says in the big book, it says we have a list. We had it when we did the four steps. made amends, became entirely ready to make amends. How's it? Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. That means no exceptions. I highly recommend that you do these steps with a sponsor, okay? Because in step 8, even though we're working on becoming willing to make amends to them all, in step 9, there may be times where it might not be appropriate to try to make direct amends to them all. And we'll get into that a little bit later. And just like anything else, going it alone in spiritual matters is not really a good deal, okay? Again, if I'm depending upon me, I'm depending upon what's between this ear and this ear, and that's the most dangerous 6 inches in the world is what's right between these two ears, because it got me in more trouble. And I need to rely sometimes on the experience of people that have been down this road before me. In the big book, it talks about the purpose of this, and it says, the purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to people about us. And in a 12 and 12, it talks about something very similar. It says, the purpose is to develop the best possible relations with every human being. And, you know, when I came into AA, you know, before I came in, I'm kind of like, there ain't nothing wrong with me, you know. What do you mean I drink too much? You know, all that defensiveness and that anger, if somebody talked to me about drinking, I'm just fighting mad, you know. And denial, I lived in denial so long, my wife thought I was an Egyptian, you know, but I would just get fighting, upset, and angry about it in denial. Then we start to say, okay, well, maybe there's something wrong with us. And then we get to the point, you know, I think I know what's wrong with me. I drink too much. But we kind of limit it at that. That's kind of where we're getting into step 1. Then we begin to look further into it, and we find out that drinking is but a symptom. And as we go back over our lives in step 4 and 5, we find out, hey, this stuff was there long before I picked up that first drink. All the drink does, you know, I think earth people, you know what earth people are, right? Okay. Yeah, I think earth people have the same character defects that we do. But what happens is, when we put something in our systems like alcohol, it removes all our inhibitions and takes all that stuff away and lowers our defenses and clouds up our thinking, my character defects get magnified. Okay? Normal people might have a little resentment, right? I don't get a little resentment. I shoot flare guns at cars on Beach Boulevard when I get mad, you know? I don't have small resentments. I go out, you know, looking for them and that type of thing. I sit in the woods, you know, with a flamethrower, and I'm waiting for these guys. We develop these character defects, and we can develop them to an extreme. We can get that to be an art. And we do step 8. We start making a list of people that we've harmed. There's several categories that we go into. And it also talks about going back over our whole lives. Last week I talked a little bit about step 4 and 5, where it said we listed and we reviewed. We listed and we reviewed. And now it talks about in step 8 that we walk back through our lives as far as memory will reach. That's back before maybe I started drinking alcohol. And I talked a little bit about some of these character defects being there long before I picked up that first drink. You know, that situation with that little girl in grade school that kind of saw me, you know, run and hide, you know, run out of the barn when I was trying to feed the horse late at night and it was dark in here, and I closed the barn door behind me, you know, and I was scared because it was dark in the barn and it was about a half mile from the house, and my mom said, you better feed that horse. I was in fourth grade, about 8 years old, and I'm in there slinging oats, you know, and throwing water and just hay all over the place because I'm trying to get out of the barn, but where it's real dark outside to where the snow was in Michigan, where it wasn't quite so dark. And I got out of the barn, I closed the door behind me, and I'm there like this, you know. I just couldn't wait to get out of there fast enough. And this little girl that lived at the farmhouse where the barn was walking by the barn, and she looked at me and she says, what's wrong? You know, well, what am I going to do as an alcoholic? I'm not going to tell her the truth. I'm scared of the dark. You know, I mean, what is she going to think of me? So what do? I make up this story. There's somebody in the barn, you know. Really? Yeah, it's a big got a knife, you know. She goes running off to the house, you know, and she's screaming, running ahead of me, screaming like crazy, runs up to my house, starts banging on a door, and tells my mom, I'm running behind her, wait a minute, you know. And, of course, by the time I get to the house, my mom's on the phone to the police. She's calling the cops are on our way out. They go out to the barn, guns drawn, flashlights all over the place, and they're looking for this intruder, you know, big guy with a knife. And all they see are these little fourth grader footprints all over the place. No Bigfoot footprints. So they come back and they start questioning me. You know, I saw somebody in the barn, huh? Yeah. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. You know what happens when an alcoholic gets caught in a lie, right? Man, you hang in there. I mean, you don't admit nothing. You just absolutely hang in there, you know? Saw something in the barn. Oh, yeah, you know. Can you describe? Oh, it's big, you know. You know, knife that long, scars, you know. I mean, the more they questioned me, and that kind of laugh, and then questioned me about it, you know. And I went on. I mean, I just did not back up at all. So then they left, you know, kind of, you know. And Mom's dad kept talking to me. Well, what about you? Jerry, you sure? Oh, yeah. So then Dad comes home. All right, tell me about this guy in a barn. Man, you hang in there. You don't back off. Years. Well, what was my reaction to that? First of all, this little girl, Patty Witt, okay, I'll never forget her. This little girl, Patty Witt, goes back to the school, and what does she do? She blabbers to everything. Yeah, Jerry's seeing things. You know, Jerry Webster's seeing things, you know. So what do? I get a resentment. Not a resentment. I get a resentment, you know. And for the next 4 years, while I'm going to grade school with this little girl, I'm putting rocks and snowballs. I mean, I'm just torturing the hell out of her. Because what does she do? She ruined my reputation. She ruined my life. See, I put the blame on somebody else. I'm externally motivated. I'm motivated and controlled by me trying to control what other people think of me. By me trying to control the world's reaction to Jerry Webster. And you can't do it. It's frustrating as all get out. For 4 years, I'm carrying this around. You know, when I got to be up to the age of 39 and I'd done the fourth step and the fifth step, you know what I did? When my dad came down for Christmas 1 year, I told him the truth. Right? I was about 8 years old when that happened. So about 30 years, I'm walking around with this thing inside me, you know. I didn't want anybody to find out that I was really afraid of the dark, you know. And stuffing it down that I really lied. And when Dad came down for Christmas 1 year after I got sober and did the fourth and fifth step, I knew he was working on his amends, and I said, Dad, I got to tell you about something. You remember that guy in the barn? He said, guy in the barn? What guy in the barn? I said, you know, back when I was in fourth grade, I said there was a guy in the barn. Oh, yeah, I remember something about it, you know. And I said, well, I says, there was really no guy in the barn, Dad. Yeah. And he kind of looked at me and says, oh, I knew that, you know. 30 years, I'm walking around, stuff the thing down inside of me, and it was a big deal to me because of what I thought other people were thinking, and it was no big deal. And when I look back on it, when we start looking at these things, that stuff was there long before I picked up the drink. I was in fourth grade. That stuff was there years and years and years before I picked up the drink. Okay? And we start making this list, we're going to find people on this list that we've harmed probably long before we picked up the first drink. I go back through this list, and I'm going to relate this again to step nine. In step nine, it says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would harm them or others. Okay? We cannot save our own butts at somebody else's expense. All right? There are certain amends that I can't make directly because it would do some harm to some innocent people. And I cannot save my own butt. But in step eight, I have to become willing to do that. I've heard, and I tell you, I get very opinionated about certain things, and this is my opinion, and I am very opinionated about it. I've heard some people say, well, if it's going to hurt you, you can't do it because you are the others. And I really think that that's what they call in Spanish, cagada del toro, okay? we're doing this for ourselves, right? And I don't believe in this stuff that, if it's going to be a little painful for us, we can't go make amends. I don't think so. I don't think so. It's very specific of what it talks about. And in the big book, it even gives an example of this guy who had done some harm to a political enemy. And he had to put his whole reputation on the line to make those amends. And he did it after talking about it with his wife, who might be affected, and his business partner that might be affected. But he had to do it. You know, there's certain times, and I'll talk about some of the amends that I've had to make, and some of them were not easy. I want to mention something about this. You know, when we go through these things, these are the first time we're going through some of these action steps. But these action steps, 4 through 9, are the basis for the ongoing program of recovery in steps 10 and 11 and 12. Okay? Actually, what we're doing later on is we're doing like little mini four steps and fifth steps as we go on. We're doing little mini six and seven steps, you know. Every time I do a 10-step, my butt gets kicked back into the into the seventh step. And we're doing little mini eight to nine steps. And I kind of liken this thing. I'm going to liken this to something. I'm a slob. Okay, all you got to do to understand I'm a slob is go look at the inside of my car. You'll know I'm a slob. All right. I'm married to a neatnik. Okay, you know what that's like? I mean, if I wake up 10 minutes late, I wake up in a made bed. But basically, I'm a slob. When I was living by myself for those 8 months down here, I mean, that little room. I mean, I had to burn down the room at the expressway inn. There's no cleaning it out. Okay. But that little room, I mean, it was a disaster. I came out of jail, and I looked at that thing, and it was a disaster. There was garbage all over the place. I mean, it just took a major house cleaning. And that's, you live like that for a while, and that's kind of the way our lives are when we're actively drinking. All right? We just keep piling on the garbage. Sorry. So, when you got five kids, you learn some of these things. Is this still on? Did I? Huh? How in the world? See? How's that? Okay. If they tied my hands, I would not be able to talk. No. I'm not even going to. Is there a doctor in here who knows what that instrument is? I'm not even going to think about it. Oh. Where was I, Dave? Huh? Oh, yeah. How'd you know? Oh, Lord. Yeah, I wish you all be serious. This is an AA meeting for crying out loud. But, thanks, Ed. I'm sorry. Is this called amends or what? Oh, Lordy. But anyway, we get in, our lives are kind of like that. Rooms full of garbage, it takes a major house clean. I mean, you got to get in there with a pitchfork and a shovel and pull all the garbage out. Then you got to get in there and take out the rugs and scrub down the floors and wash the walls and paint everything new and then put new rugs back in, new furniture back in, everything else. That's what this house cleaning is. That's how we end up with steps 8 to 9. We're finally cleaning up the wreckage of the past. Well, later on, guess what happens? If I don't want that stuff to start piling up again, I'm going to have to start cleaning it up on a daily basis. If I dust the house once a week, wash the floors once a week, if I sweep it once in a while, wash the dishes, don't let them pile up. I used to always know how many dishes I had, I put them in a bathtub, let them pile up, and I knew exactly how many I used during a week. But I really was a slob. I'm not much better now. But we don't let the stuff pile up anymore. And that's what the ongoing steps are, steps 10, 11, and 12. We don't let the stuff pile up anymore. But it takes a major house cleaning to begin with. I had, it's very specific about certain things in step 9 and 10. In the 12 and 12, it talks about there's certain kinds of amends that you need to make. One is as soon as possible, as soon as you can. And sometimes you don't have to wait, until you get to that. But you need to talk with a sponsor about it. Some of the amends that you make, if you're living with the people, you need to start making some amends if you're living with the people. If you're rubbing elbows with them on a constant basis, whether they're at work or whatever else, you might start thinking about doing that early in the game. Because you can't wait until you get perfect. they're going to be holding on to some stuff too. And I'll tell you what, I never realized. I think it took me quite a while for me to realize the damage that I had done. Especially the damage that I had done to the people that I love the most. My wife, what really struck me was I got sober. We'd been separated for 6 months, and then I got sober, and then 2 months later, she came back. That tells you how sick some Al-Anons are. I wasn't too sure I wanted to have a relationship with anybody who was sick enough to have a relationship with me yet. But anyway, we got back together, and she didn't trust me. I mean, I came home from a meeting and she'd go, yeah, man, just automatic. When she kissed me, she'd smell my breath. And I said, what do you smell my breath for? And she was not even aware she's doing it, right? If I work late, like once a month, we'd have the proofs come out in the magazine, and I call her up and I tell her the proofs came out. I was working for a magazine in advertising. I say, I gotta go over the proofs. I gotta get them to the printers before the morning. So I'm gonna be late. I'll call you before I come home, and just bear with me. I don't know how long it's gonna take because I never knew how many corrections I had. So I'd be there, and about 7 o'clock, I hear ring, ring. And I pick up the phone. Hey, Jerry. She says, yeah, honey, this is Ann. Can you bring home a loaf of bread? We don't have any bread for the kids' sandwiches for tomorrow. Yeah, sure. Anything else you need? No. Okay. So I'd hang up the phone. 40 minutes later, ring, ring. Oh, Jerry. You know, hi, honey. You know, we don't have any milk for the cereal in the morning. We need some milk too. Can you get some milk on the way? Oh, yeah, sure. Anything else you need? No, that's it. That's it. You know, 8:20. Ring, ring. Yan, what do you want? You know, we need some eggs. You know. I mean, finally, I get out of there about 9:30 at night. Call her. Okay, I'm on my way home. I'll stop at the store. And I get home. I on the way home, I stop off and I buy the milk, the bread, and the eggs. And I get home and I open the refrigerator. And guess what's in the refrigerator? Milk and eggs. Yeah. No, we don't put the bread in it. And then I open the bread box. You know. And what's in the bread box? Bread. Right. And she didn't trust me. Why didn't she trust me? Anybody been bitten by a dog? Ever been bitten by a dog? I was bit by a dog when I was a kid. Me and a neighbor kid were wrestling around, and they had this big German Shepherd dog. Okay. And I just thought I'd clarify it, you know, anybody else dream damage out there besides me. We had this big German Shepherd, and the German Shepherd thought I was hurting this kid. So he came up, you know, and he took off a bite out of my heel. I mean, he took off the... I did that well, didn't I? He took off the heel of the boot that I was on and bit through the boot into my heel, right? What does this neighborhood kid do, all right? He says, oh, it's okay. And he gets a dog calmed down, and he says, come on over and let him smell your hand so he knows you're okay, right? Yeah, right. I'm going to put my hand right there on the... You know, that type of thing. He says, hey, go ahead and pet him so he knows everything's up. Okay, no, you know... Yeah, what was my reaction for the next few years after that? I walk in the door, where's the dog, you know? I seem to have a lot of problems with dogs, I don't know why. Where's the dog, you know? I wouldn't let that dog behind me for a long time, right? Why? I mean, he bit me once. I'm not going to let him get behind me again, right? So one time like that, I've been bit once, and I get very mistrustful. It was a long time before automatically I had to keep going over the house, and the dog might not bite me, go over the house, dog not bite me. And after about a year, I forgot about where the dog was when I walked in. Okay? Well, guess what? My wife had been bitten. Well, no, don't let your images run away with that. She had been disappointed with my behaviors for a long time. A lot of broken promises, a lot of dashed hopes. I mean, if you can imagine 2 years in and out of the program of alcoholics, I'm going to get better now, honey. You know, that type of thing. What did she expect? Okay, I mean, she hadn't been bitten once. She had been bitten over and over and over again. And here I am. I'm upset because she doesn't trust me. Well, you know how she learns how to trust? When I acted trustworthy for a long enough period of time. And I don't know for sure when that was. I just know that one day, probably around a year, I walk home and she went, and there was no, and it became automatic. I guess it was somewhere in the back. She could not make herself trust me. You can't give trust away. It's something that happens. It's spontaneous. But once it happened, it was fine. And I guarantee you, she knows I'm here tonight. She's not calling the jail. She's not calling the hospitals. You know, she's not calling the police station, find out where I'm at. And am I really there at work to see? She's not calling the club, see if I'm really doing the steps, all that kind of stuff. But that's one of the things. I had done a lot of harm there. I had hesitated about talking about this, but... I'll tell you how serious this program is to me. I'll tell you about an incident that happened. And it was the one thing that I could not handle. I could not forgive Jerry for this. I really could not forgive me for this. Okay. My last slip started with a joint in Charleston, South Carolina, with my brother-in-law. He says, well, you can't drink, but you can have a joint with me, can't you? Let's go for a ride. And I said, no, you know, but I went for a ride with him and then inhaled deeply while he was smoking the joint in the rolled up windows of the car. And he says, well, you know, I know you can't have a joint, but one hit can't hurt you, okay, will it? And I says, well, probably not, you know. And he passed me the roach, and I took one hit. Then he was rolling up another one, and he lit it, and he passed it to me, and I'm smoking it without even thinking about it. And then we pull up to a red light, and he starts laughing, because you kind of get giddy when you smoke pot, you know? Yeah, yeah. And I said, what are you laughing at? And he says, you're 50 feet from a red light, you know. I mean, he had tolerance to it. I didn't have any tolerance to it. You know, that he had some good stuff, too. So I'm looking at the red light, and this kind of goes, whoa, you know. I can't have time. You know, you can tell how drunks drive because they weave. All right, you know how you can tell when potheads drive? Because it's like driving with a broken speedometer. You know, they speed up, and then they slow down. And they speed up, and then they slow down, you know. And then they stop 30 feet from the red light, you know. And every time I see it, I want to roll down my window and honk the horn and say, hey, you ought to quit smoking that wacky weed. And he says, I already know. But anyway, that's what was happening. And so I pulled up again, and this time he's just roaring with laughter. And I said, what's wrong? And he says, hey, you're still 20 feet from the red light. And I just said, without even thinking about it, oh, what the hell, I'm already high. Let's just go get drunk. And we did that night. And my wife was staying with my sister at the house, and me and my brother-in-law, we went out, and we did not make it home till the wee hours of the morning. And we were in not good shape. And, of course, my wife was very upset with me, and we ended up driving back. I ended up driving back to Jacksonville from Folly Beach, South Carolina, drunk and arguing with her the whole way. Because you know how we get when somebody confronts us with our behavior? We get very defensive, and we get very angry. Because that, to me, that was the best defense. When we got home, the argument continued. I don't remember this, but I was told about this. And at one point, I apparently had gotten her in a hallway and was throttling her. And my 8-year-old son, my oldest son, who was terrified of me at that time because of my drinking behavior, came out of the hall and jumped on my leg and bit me on the ass. I mean, his teeth went in, and when I went up, he went up with me. Okay? And I ended up kicking him all the way down the hallway. I'm not proud of that, but that's part of my story. That's when my wife was on the phone and saying, you will have to leave. You know, if you want to destroy yourself, that's one thing, but you're not taking me and the kids with you. And that's when I ended up down here in Jacksonville. And that's why I say when I was down here and I was living down here, if the motel room that I checked into had a mirror in it when I checked in, it did not have a mirror in it when I checked out, because I saw what was staring back at me. And invariably, I would get drunk and I would smash it with my fist because I did not like Jerry Webster that much anymore. Okay? Well, after my wife joined me, after 2 months of sobriety, my wife and kids came back. And that was, I got sober in March, and about May, they came back and came down here and joined me from Charlotte, North Carolina. And in September, my son had just turned 9, and he was starting school, and he was playing on a playground, and I was working at the daytime at the magazine, and I got this frantic call from my wife, and she said, there's something wrong with Mike. I'm at the hospital. She had taken him to the children's hospital. And I said, well, what's wrong? She says, I don't know. He got hurt on a playground, and he's urinating blood. There's something wrong. And I went charging off to this hospital. We waited. I said, I got to go. Told my boss, I got to go. And here he was. He was stuck up with tubes stuck up all over him. He had fallen down. He was urinating blood. And they were doing all kinds of tests. I was afraid to stay in a hospital room a night, so I agreed to stay there. And there was no bed, there was just like a reclining chair. I agreed to stay there at night, and I could sleep in that chair, but he wouldn't be alone, so he wouldn't be afraid. And my wife would go home during the daytime, or during the nighttime and sleep, and then she'd come back in the daytime and stay with him, and I'd get up, run home, shower, and go to work, and right from work, go back to the hospital. And that first night when he was in the hospital, I asked the doctors, I said, what is wrong? Because the doctors had told us that they were going to have to operate, and that they were going to remove a kidney, and they were going to try to save the other kidney. And a doctor came around for his rounds that night, and I said, how is this possible? I mean, how in the world is this possible? A couple of kids playing in a playground and fall off a swing, and all of a sudden, and the doctor told us there was no guarantees because they didn't know how much damage for sure had been done. They couldn't tell. And I don't know whether he suspected something or not. And he says, Mr. Webster, he says, I'd like to show you something. So Mike was asleep, and he took me down a hallway to where they had the x-rays on the wall, and he put up Mike's x-rays. And he says, this wasn't done on a playground. This was done a long time ago. And all that happened on the playground was that it tore the scar tissue, and it's probably a good thing. And he was showing me where it had just deteriorated almost to where the two joined together, and he didn't know how far it was gone and whether he could save the other one or not. And when he said that, I knew that I was the one that had done it. And I went back to that room. This is the last time that I had ever wanted to drink. I went back in that room, and I could not pray. I was ashamed to call my sponsor. I was ashamed to tell anybody. And before I knew it, I was thinking about what bars were open. You know, where can I just go just to get a little relief, just for a little bit, for a minute, just to make it go away, you know, put the world on hold. And I called myself, my God, what am I thinking of? You know, I mean, this is what caused all this stuff. But I could not get that out of my mind. And for some reason, and this is the first time that I really, really got on my knees. I mean, I got on my knees at my son's bedside, and I said, God help me. I cannot handle this. I cannot handle this. And I heard in these meetings that if I let you, you will. And I'm going to let you because I can't handle it. And from somewhere outside of me, I remembered that Bill Wilson, when he was confronted with an overpowering desire to drink, would go seek out another alcoholic to work with. And I didn't know any other alcoholics in the children's hospital. But I knew there was one room that I had avoided like the plague, and that was the parents' waiting room. Because those people were talking about their problems. I didn't want to hear about their problems. I had enough of my own. But I thought, well, they're not alcoholic, but they're hurting. And for right now, that's close enough. And so I had a big book with me, and I waited until Mike was sound asleep, and I went down to the parents' waiting room. And there was a few other people there, and one by one they drifted off until about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was just me and one other lady sitting there. And she looked at the big book, and she says, how long have you been in the program? And her son was in the hospital. And we talked. I mean, we had our own little AA meeting all night long, and I didn't go out and pick up a drink. The obsession to drink was removed from me that night. Okay, and you know when I said I thought I was too bad to pray, that I had done some things I was too bad to pray, that's what I'm talking about. And you know, God, I believe that He has forgiven me. I'm sober. And you know what? I don't deserve to be sober. You know what that makes that? You know what that makes that? That makes that a beautiful, wonderful gift, because if I deserved it, it wouldn't be a gift. And I can never repay that, okay? But that makes it a gift. How do I make amends for some of the damage that I've done? How do you tell a 9-year-old kid why Dad did the things that he did, okay? I don't know that I could make direct amends that way to a 9-year-old kid that might not understand it. But you know some of the ways that we make amends nowadays? One of the ways that I make amends to my wife, I don't go discussing all my, you know, activities. But I try to be a faithful husband. I try to treat her with respect. I try to show her love. I try to be the husband I never was. One of the ways I make amends to my kids that were too young to understand why Dad was the way he was is I try to act like a father. Okay. And it must have been about 6 months later. And you know, all this time before this happened, I'm complaining to Ed, my sponsor, you know, what's wrong with these kids? They don't love me. And Ed kept saying, leave the kids alone. The kids aren't the problem. And see, that's my addiction. I'm my alcoholism. I'm trying to control the world's reaction to Jerry Webster. And in recovery, what we do through these steps, we begin to work on principles. We begin to work internally, be motivated internally instead of externally by what the world thinks of me. Internally by principles and by ethics, by what's right and what we need to do. Okay? And you know the amazing thing about that is, when I begin to operate from internal motivation, you know what happens on the outside? the world reacts differently. And my sponsor kept saying, you need to do the steps, and I started doing the steps, and I started getting into the action steps. And about 6 months later, you spill a drink too? Okay. Must be something going around. And about 6 months later, I came home from work one night. By the way, my son, he had the operation. They saved the other kidney. You had to nail his shoes to the floor to hold him down after that. And they saved not only the one kidney, they saved part of the other kidney. It was not quite as bad as he made out. And that boy is married, and he's in the Air Force, and he's doing wonderful today. And we love each other. But I left him alone. I started working on Jerry and started changing the way Jerry acts, the way Jerry lives, what Jerry's reaction to the world is. And I came home from work one night, and my wife says, Jerry, Mike wants to see you. And it was late, and I said, what's wrong? She said, nothing, he just wants to talk to you. And I went into the bedroom where he was, and this is about 6 months after his operation, and I said, Mike, Mom said you wanted to talk to me, what's wrong? And he says, oh, nothing, Dad. He said, Mr. Johnson, our scoutmaster, is moving back up to Atlanta. I said, yeah, I heard that. He said, well, Dad, he asked us if we knew of anybody that could be a scoutmaster. And I was wondering if you'd be my scoutmaster. I mean, I just hugged him and bawled. I love to be a scoutmaster, you know. It was like, it's gone. It's gone. And I just hugged him and cried. And I tell you what, we went in the woods for 2 years after that. I guarantee you, he would not have wanted to spend a night in the woods with this drunk before then. But I was a scoutmaster for 2 years, and we just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And the relationship has changed. The amends we make, what I'm saying is the amends you make, you're trying to set right the damage that's done. We may never be able to do it. You know that? But we do the best we can with it. You do the best that you can. And this isn't necessarily for the other guy. It's not necessarily for Mike. It's not necessarily for my wife. But you know what? I walk around free and loose and happy in this skin. I don't worry about what Mike's thinking of me and what Ann's thinking of me. I'm not worried about whether she knows, you know, where I'm at. You know? And she's not worried about where I'm at. She doesn't question my love for her anymore. Okay? I mean, my sponsor told me at first, because I had a little problem in the plumbing department, that I had to start dating her all over again. I think that had a lot to do with guilt and remorse, because it just went away. I thought, damn, I got sober, and now this thing doesn't work anymore. What am I going to do? Rot and fall off or something, you know? It took me 2 months to go ask my sponsor about it, and he just said, well, Jerry, he laughed. First of all, I asked him in a club, I says, Ed, I got to talk to you. I got this problem. He says, yeah, what is it? You know, in the clubhouse. No, not in here. We've got to go outside, you know. So we go out in the parking lot, and there's people around. I says, Ed, I got to talk to you. Yeah, what is it, Jerry? And I said, no, let's go back over here by the car. You know? We go in the car, sit in the car, roll up all the windows, you know, turn on the air conditioning and the radio, and says, okay, Ed, you know. He said, well, turn on the radio so I can hear you. And I told him, and he laughed. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, talk about ego deflation in the extreme. And he says, don't worry about it. He says, that's not uncommon. I didn't know that. I mean, I thought it was terminally unique, you know. He says, that's not uncommon. And what he explained to me is that alcohol had been such a part of my life for so long, especially in a relationship and a part of sex. I mean, it was like foreplay to me. I don't think I did anything unless I had a drink first, you know. That all of a sudden you take away the drink, and that was so connected that nothing else worked for a while. He says, start dating your wife again. Well, you know, first couple of times I brought her a rose, she's kind of like, what'd you do now? You know, I mean, it's totally unexpected behavior. Like, what's going on? You know, and just surprise her with something. Take her out to dinner, or take her to a movie, or bring her a rose, or anything at all. Anything at all. And it was like, she didn't know what to do with this. It's like, what happened here? What's going on? What is he doing really? You know, what's he trying to make up for? And finally, she just got to the point where she could accept that. And then, miraculously, the plumbing started working. It's better than ever. And, you know, I don't know what to say, but everything seems to work out just fine. But we haven't had any more kids since then either. I tell you what, you know, I hadn't been in too joking of a mood tonight. And I think I knew I was going to talk about this. I had debated whether talking about this or not. And basically what I'm doing is I'm trusting you all with this. Because this is, you know, this is the thing I wasn't going to tell anybody. This is the thing I was going to take with me to my grave. And I don't think anything to me means more on what the miracle of this program is than that incident. And see, there's proof that God's forgiven me today. You know, he did something for me I could not do for myself. What's the proof? I haven't had to pick up a drink in 13 years. My relationships with the people that I love the most have been restored. I don't get fired too often. I haven't been fired in a year or so. You know, people trust me. I mean, you guys asked me to do the steps. I mean, that's just absolutely boggles my mind. It really does. That you all would ask me to do the steps, considering the struggle I had with this thing and everything I had to go through to get this thing. I mean, you'd think you'd ask somebody that knew how to do it the first time, just kind of whip through it. But man, I had to fight and scream and kick and all that kind of stuff. I had a hell of a time with it. But you know what? Sometimes the lessons hardest learned are the ones longest remembered. And I finally got to the point at some point in time where, you know, if God's forgiven me and he's demonstrated I'm sober and I don't deserve to be, and it's a wonderful gift, that's what makes it a gift, then who the hell am I to not forgive me? Who the hell am I not to forgive myself? I'm certainly not greater than God. And I can't do anything that's so big that the God that created this beautiful earth that we're on, and the sun and the moon and all their correct orbits, and the tides coming in at exactly the right time, that he created all that. I can't create anything so big that he can't forgive it. So he did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I have to kind of accept that. And I talk about that too because, you know, when we get into step 8 and step 9, it says sometimes we go to enemies. Well, if I've been really, really honest about myself in step 4 and 5, then it's awfully hard for me to not be willing to accept somebody else the way they are at that time. To not be willing to maybe forgive somebody else and let that go, if I've been really honest. Because I look back on it, and you know, the people that I had that I thought I had to forgive, I mean, nothing. They were nothing like Jerry Webster was when he was drinking. Okay? And in the beginning, not picking up that first drink was a struggle before all this stuff happened. I mean, I'd mow the lawn, and you know how that works, the timing. I think the devil has a satellite up there, and he's saying, okay, he's coming in from mowing the lawn in the summer, he's hot and he's sweaty, that the football game is on or that the baseball game is on, throw on the beer commercial, you know, and as soon as you walk in, they have that frosted mug, and my tongue hits the floor and it picks up lint, and it's just, you can almost taste it, you know. Why do they do this right then? Or you're driving down the road and have the Chevy's Regal sign, and it's a huge billboard, right? Big, tall bottle, and it says, not actual size. Too bad. I mean, that had to be written by an alcoholic, you know. Just, and this stuff would just, I mean, it'd just kick it in. I could just taste it for a while. And I got to quit talking about this, because I did this one time. I went on and on and on. Three guys get up and said, oh, I'm going to get a drink, you know, left the meeting. But you know what? It was hard for me to choose not to drink. And my sponsor says, try some mental judo. I said, what do you mean mental judo? He says, think it all the way through. All the way through. Don't think about the taste. If you're having trouble getting that thought out of your mind, think it all the way through. Think about the worst time you ever had in your life. The worst thing that ever happened to you in your life. And you know, when I see a bottle now, I don't see a bottle. I see a kid hooked up to IVs in a hospital bed. And it's real easy for me to choose not to drink. Because what I'm choosing, I'm not choosing to drink or not to drink. I'm choosing, do I want to be the person that I'm becoming through this person, through this program, and through the grace of God and a wonderful fellowship and the way people have helped me? Or do I want to be the person that I was? And I'll tell you what, man, that is an easy, easy choice. I really appreciate y'all bearing with me. I'll try to get funny again next week, okay? And I love you all, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it.